Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz, episode 96 for November 19th, 2009. BioPearl. Floss Weekly is brought to you by the new voice-activated Sync featuring hands-free calling, music search, and turn-by-turn navigation. Available exclusively on Ford, Lincoln, and Mercury vehicles. For more details and to enter to win a free Nano or Zune, visit SyncMyRidePodcast.com.
And by listeners like you. Thanks so much for your contribution. We couldn't do TWiT without it.
It's time for Floss Weekly, the show that covers all things open source, free, libre, open source software. That's what Floss stands for. And our flosser, our chief flosser is here, Mr. Randall Schwartz from Stonehenge.com, creator of...
Good to see you again. Good to talk to you again.
Nice to talk to you, too. I was going to give you a plug for your book, Learning Perl. Now in Ruski. Look at that Ruski version.
Yes. I just got a copy in the mail the other day. It's I translated into Russian, which I think is my first Russian translation. I think the Programming Perl first edition was also translated into Russian. But I think this makes this 11 now, the number of languages that Learning Perl has been translated into. So it's available worldwide.
Do they look open inside? So the prose must be Russian, but the code has got to be in the Latin alphabet and English, right?
The code is still in English, and okay. It's funny because the comments are in Russian.
Well, of course they are.
So it's like, for example, my dollar names equals Fred or Barney if dollar names matches this regular expression. And then it's got some Cyrillic letters over here. I have no idea what that means, right? Fredsky and Barneyski.
Freddy.
Is that real Russian?
No, I'm making that up. I'm playing with you.
You do that so well. Playing with you. Amazing.
So, no, it's all about talking like this, and everybody thinks you're talking Russian.
So that's cool. Congratulations. That's wonderful.
Yes, we have a great show lined up today.
But before
we get to that, let me talk a little bit about last week, between last taping of this show and this week's taping of the show, I did Ignite Salem. Now, Ignite is this program where they select 15 to 20 speakers that only have 5 minutes to deliver their material. It's kind of a junior TED, except it's 5 minutes to 17 minutes. And the slides automatically advance every 15 seconds. So you kind of have to deal with that. If you go to YouTube right now, you'll find on YouTube my video that was shot. Actually shot with my brand new Canon 7D. I just got the 7D. We shot HD video with my 7D. So if you go to YouTube and look for Ignite Salem 2, my name, Randall Schwartz, you'll find the video that I shot for that. I'm doing that same program coming up tomorrow, but I'll say that for the end of the show to talk about. But go check that out. It was a lot of fun. Karaoke for Fun and Profit. I was able to get the message across. A lot of people considered it inspiring, which means I was on track. So it was a lot of fun doing that. So go check that out. Check out my new 7D pictures. I'm really excited about my 7D.
You like that, huh? You like that camera?
Oh, my God. 8 frames a second on motor drive.
Far out.
It's a 18 megapixel. It's a lovely camera. I'm taking it with me on the cruise in a few weeks. Caribbean again, so it'll be a lot of fun going there. Also, again, before we start the meat of the show, I've got to say, because every host has to be on their own apparently for this, please go to podcastawards.com, and down there at the bottom you get to vote once a day, every day until, is it November 30th? No,
yep.
Yeah, I think it's 30th.
Yep.
Once a day, and you can. I am excited to have been nominated. That I'm fine with that. However, when you get down the technology category, you can choose me or Steve Gibson or Callie Lewis or a bunch of other people there. But, you're listening to this show. Why don't you vote for me? There we go. There's my pitch.
There's the plug. Just vote for me. You know, yeah. I've been telling people, because we're nominated in a lot of different categories, in many categories, double nominated, which means we're, TWiT networks are against each other.
Yeah.
And I'm just telling people, the best thing to do is you want to support podcasting, go and vote for, whatever your favorites are, whatever they might be.
As I'm telling people, vote with your liver.
Vote with your liver. And actually, you get to vote once a day. So vote with your liver daily.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
That would be our advice to you. I think that's great. And thanks to Todd Cochran and for putting that together, and Blueberry, and may the best podcast win.
Mm-hmm. All of the best podcasts win, and most of them will be on your network, I can already tell.
In just a bit, well, we got a lot of nominations, and I'm thrilled about that. In just a bit, we're going to talk about BioPearl.
Mm-hmm. We have a couple of guests on BioPearl. We've got Jason Stajek, Jason Stajek, something like that.
Yep.
And Chris Fields, who are both senior representatives from the BioPearl project. So a suggestion came in from a write-in that somebody did a few months ago for the show. I'm sure the show's going to go over my head, so we've got a couple of extra special hosts for this show, too, but we'll get to them in a minute.
Well, and as you heard, Dr. Kiki is also here. That's our special guest, and Mark Pelletier. But
yes.
Before we talk about that, I want to talk about Ford Sync. My friends at Ford have done an amazing job building into their Ford, Lincoln, and Mercury vehicles what I have to say is simply the best. And I say this with absolute sincerity, having tried a great many of them. Hands-free system. Now, of course, you get hands-free Bluetooth. By the way, I many different phones at the same time. I think it's 25 is the limit. So somebody like me, I have a couple of phones. But if you know, it's you, your spouse, the kids have phones. All of them can work with the hands-free calling. Isn't that nice? If you have the proper kinds of phones, if they support this Bluetooth profile, the Sync will read text messages to you. The whole idea of Sync is it's really a safety feature. The idea is to keep your eyes on the road and your hands on the wheel at all times, even if you want to put on a different song or listen to a different music source or even get turn-by-turn directions. At no time do you have to look away from the road or take your hands off the wheel. The Ford Sync button on your steering wheel, you press it, and then you talk to Sync and you tell it what you want. It could be something as simple as call Randall Schwartz at home. It could be something a little more complicated like read text message or even play the New York Times front page or sports scores. If you've got a fantasy league, it'll give you fantasy league results updated hourly. I mean, this thing is incredible. I love the music Sync because, it works with a Zune. It works with an iPod. It works with an iPhone. Works with my Droid. It'll even work with a USB key. As long as that USB device, there's a USB port on the Sync, and if that USB device has tagged MP3 files on it, it will index them, it will know what's on there, and you can call for it by name. You can even say play similar songs, which is very cool. You could get, they've got great 911 assist, very handy, you know, if for emergencies. Vehicle health report, business searches, personalized news, sports, weather, and traffic reports. Look, I want you just to take a look at Ford Sync. You go to SyncMyRidePodcast.com and find out more. And while you're there, learn about the contest. They're giving away 15 Zunes and iPods. One of, I don't know if it's one of each, or I guess the idea is you get to choose. So you get to pick what you want. But they're doing that now through December 8th. So if you'd like to find out more about that, just go to SyncMyRidePodcast.com. And to enter, all you have to, I mean, I'll tell you the rules. All you have to do is tweet, I love Floss Weekly. That Randall Schwartz, he's such a hunk of burning open source. And then put the hashtag #SyncMyRidePodcast on. You don't have to say the open source hunk of thing if you want. #SyncMyRidePodcast. You'll get an automatic entry to win that free Nano or Zune. Find out more, SyncMyRidePodcast.com. And the next time you're at a Ford, Lincoln, or Mercury dealer, do me a favor. Do yourself a favor. Take a look at Ford Sync. It is truly awesome. I feel like I'm in my my Knight Rider car, Randall, when I get in my Mustang and I talk to my car. It's so cool. All right, we have amassed such a large group of people here. I don't think there's ever been so many people on Twit, Randall.
Like the Brady Bunch.
Yeah, it's like the Brady Bunch, exactly. Here's the story of a programming language. So sitting in the studio with me, I thought, you know, we should have some more scientists in here, more brain power. Kirsten Sanford has joined us. Also with us from our Futures in Biotech show, Mark Pelletier. It's great to have you, Mark.
Thank you.
And then the BioPearl fellas, starting with Chris Fields. Oh, is that right? I got the right person.
Yeah, that's right.
And Jason Stajek. Got it right. And now, Randall, you can ask the first question. Because so, I don't have a thing to say.
So, okay, so I obviously I know a lot about Pearl. I only know a little bit about BioPearl because of my friend Lincoln Stein, who I think was involved with it pretty much from the beginning. But can you tell us, Jason, a little history of actually, maybe Chris should take this question, but whoever, either one of you.
Let's say Jason is probably the best to answer that.
So let's start with that. So what is BioPearl? How did it start? And how is it not just Pearl?
Okay. What is BioPearl? BioPearl is just a set of Pearl modules to deal with biological data. And it's mostly focused on sequence data, and we can talk a little bit more about the other kinds of areas that we cover. It was started about 1995, sort of when the times when the Human Genome Projects and several other genome projects were getting started. Actually, the Yeast Genome Project and the first worm project, C. elegans, was being done. And that's actually where Lincoln Stein got involved at the early stages as well. But he was doing his own sort of Pearl projects, and there was another group of people at the Sanger Center and the European Bioinformatics Institute and some groups in the U.S., at MIT and St. Louis that were doing genome sequencing, and they needed tools to analyze their data. And so there was a lot of collaboration sort of fostered at some meetings to try to build useful Pearl modules to deal with the kind of data that they were generating.
Now,
so that's kind of what started.
I've got to ask for this then. Why? So in 1995, Pearl was only one of many scripting languages at that point. Why Pearl?
I think there initially was some CGI stuff that they were trying to do, so it probably had to do with CGI.pm was probably part of the interest, and probably just a lot of the people, I guess one history of bioinformatics is that a lot of people who got called into doing service in bioinformatics were system administrators first and trying to deal with all the data, and they were probably asked, you know, along the way to, hey, can you analyze this for me too while you're getting that data out? And they probably use the languages that they were most familiar with and were using. So I don't know what other sort of competing projects there were at the time. I didn't join until about 2000, but about 2000, 1999, that time frame. But that was kind of where that was the origins of the group. And there are several people that kind of spearheaded that project, and they've gone to move on to do work on other things. But that was kind of the origins of a collaborative project.
Now, the part of the problem was dealing with large amounts of data, because like the genetic information is fairly huge, right? Is this something that the Pearl modules that go with BioPearl are particularly suited for?
I guess they are. I mean, part of really what we're dealing with is text data. A lot of the data that comes out of the sequencing projects is essentially just simple ASCII data, and then it's all about munging that into different formats or sending that to different analysis programs and then getting the results from those analysis programs. And so really you just need a language that could process all of that text data and filter it. And so, yes, there is a lot of data, but it's the heavy lifting of the computational analyses often is done through some other sort of more specialized programs, but the Pearl aspects or the scripting aspects are about kind of the front end and the back end of a lot of that.
Mind if I ask a question? So maybe you could describe a little bit what are some of the most basic functions that you can do with BioPearl, and then describe the Pearl core that's underneath it and why you went with Pearl in the context of, for example, a simple sequence alignment. So sure. I'm asking because I'd be very interested in using it. The software analysis, the software that's available right now, if you use Vector NTI, it's about $5,000 for someone who's not in academia, and it doesn't make sense for an alignment.
Right. Chris, do you want to go, or do you want me to cover it?
Well, as you mentioned previously, the BioPearl was originally structured around sequences, biological sequences. And the classes that are within BioPearl are used to describe sequences, features within sequences, and that can be piped to various analysis programs in a very specific way. I mean, you have different programs that require different input, and BioPearl standardizes that and makes it easier to pipeline data back and forth. And also on the back end of that, when you have a specific analysis that you're performing, such as a blast analysis, you can parse the output of that and use it in downstream applications, such as, and in fact, this ties back to Lincoln and some of the genome browser software that Lincoln has been developing, GBrowse, for instance. So it's a toolkit, and it's a toolkit that makes running some of these pipelines and these analyses easier. I guess that's the best way I could put it.
Is it worth, like, it's not a question of is it worth. Is it possible to set it up to do to use as tools for cloning? And when I want to do my I just cloned the gene of interest. I've sent it off for sequence. I get 800 bases back. I get another 800 bases back from the sequence in the reverse direction. Can I set this up as a platform just to say, here are the two alignments, one construct, you know, one genetic construct, and then run it through to make sure that it's okay? Will it do a contig? Is an assembly of a series of sequences. Is it worth it on a sequence?
It will take the sequences that you have from the different sequencing reads and pipe that into the right programs to assemble those, and then read the output of those programs and put that into, let's say, a contig class. And that's actually one of the areas right now we're trying to strengthen, which I'm sure will come up at a later point, some of the future directions that we have with BioPerl.
And can you do it off a pyro sequencing machine that might sequence a whole genome in an afternoon? Does it scale to that level?
That's one of the aspects that we're actually challenged by right now, is that we have pyro sequencing machines that throw off, instead of, let's say, a few sequences at a time, millions of sequences at a time. We have next generation sequencers like the 454 that throw off tons and tons of data, and so we're having to deal with large scale analyses like that, and so that's going to be a one of the future directions that we want to take BioPerl.
I'd think that, you know, this kind of if you're looking with pyro sequencing, to give a little bit of background here, pyro sequencing is a methodology that allows you to sequence a bacterial genome in an afternoon, and you know, a large data set where you might be pooling all the living matter in a certain area, just pull it all together, mush it, isolate the RNA, and just blast it and use it as a form of tricorder. Right?
And that's what we're hoping that we'll be doing, right? It'll fit in your hand too. That's going to be the important part. But I think to deal with the data, like Chris was saying, I mean, so the BioPerl is really good as the glue, right? Or it's the, you know, it's the duct tape of a lot of bioinformatics, to sort of take the analogy further for Perl. And so the analysis for trying to match those reads that you get off of the sequencer to known data, or to assemble it into its own assembly, there are more specialized tools that focus on that. But often the hard part is not so much running those programs, although they have their challenges. It's how do I then take it from the results from that program and then add other information to it. So, for example, annotate those reads, those contigs that you've gotten. And that involves running additional sequence analyses. So, for example, to take Mark's example, where you're sequencing a sample, what we call metagenomics, you sample some soil, and you want to know what's in there, you would sequence it, you would try to do some sort of assembly to reduce the number of sequences down to essentially remove the redundancy. And then you would search those against a database of known proteins, for example, and you would translate those DNA sequences into putative proteins and see what they matched. And that gives you some sort of composition, for example, of the kinds of proteins that are there, or you could just try to match them against sort of a set of known unknown sequences that are... like barcodes, and that's sort of part of this Barcode of Life project, is to be able to do a better job of essentially taking an unknown sequence and figuring out what it is. So the tools for doing the alignments are tools like BLAST or FASTA or Smith-Waterman, or some more optimized tools for the short reads. Those are all highly optimized C programs that use as much many of the tricks as they can to get as much speed out of the computer as possible. But then they're kind of like they're like one tool that does that particular kind of analysis. And then the challenge is to take that whole mass of information you just got out of that analysis and make sense of it. And that's why we do a lot of that in Perl as a way to script that and to make it easier for somebody to get in there and really kind of ask questions that where the right way to do it isn't exactly clear, or the right path to take isn't always clear.
Is BioPerl mostly then the glue between heavier lifting programs then, or is it a collection of tools and techniques? Now, is it sort of end user friendly, or is it really just a toolkit for programmers to build their own custom setup wherever they're at?
Did you want to take that, Jason?
Sure. I mean, so it really is a toolkit, because it was really a toolkit built by developers who were trying to do these things. So most of the main users are going to be programmers. Now, we get a lot of flack for that, and we do have ways that we're trying to add kind of levels on top of that. But it is first and foremost a toolkit, because that's what the main developers need. And so I think we're still... we're still trying to find the right balance between sort of serving the needs that we have as well as serving the needs of additional community members. Chris, did you want to fill in anything there too?
Well, for our particular purposes here locally, I work with several different groups, one that's working on the honeybee genome, one that's working on a songbird. And one of the aspects that we have is we're looking at evolutionary analyses, like phylogenetic analyses. We're looking at assembly issues, because we're working with genome sequences. We're working with gene expression. And the problem that we face is that most of these tasks, these programs, these high-throughput programs, these optimized programs, take different inputs. And so BioPerl has the capability of making those different you can use this as a pipe going from one analysis to another in an easier way, I guess. And then on the back end of that, taking the results that you get from such an analysis and then piping it in to another possible downstream analysis, so you can create custom pipelines of data or data analyses, depending on what you're trying to accomplish. The problem is the tasks that we face are so diverse that we try to make it easier to construct the pipelines. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so you're saying that really a programmer is going to get involved here. It's not really an end user thing. It's not really just for a scientist to use, a researcher to use. It's sort of you still need kind of the researcher / programmer that's over in the corner of the lab that can take these high performance programs and glue them together with BioPerl in a way that's deemed necessary for the experiments you're trying to run or the result you're trying to accomplish. Is that a fair assessment then?
Right. I think it's a fair assessment. In fact, I'd say, Jason, I don't know how much of the code has come from, I guess, bench researchers. I was a bench researcher, and I'm really more into informatics now. But I'd say a good chunk of the code has come from people who work in a lab on the specific organisms or specific sequencing projects that are going on, and they actually develop their own tools to generate the data and to run these analyses.
Actually, let's can we step back a bit for a second then? Bioinformatics must be a huge and growing field then. Are people coming into this mostly with a biology background and learning the computer science, or are they coming in mostly with computer science and adding biology, or is there just specialized fields that come right up the middle, specialized training right up the middle, or how is that mostly happening these days?
I see it coming from both ends, actually, here. That sounds kind of bad, but
that's a joke.
I see it coming from the computational side. When people are coming in that have unique answers to specific questions, and you know, something that biologists wouldn't necessarily think about, but also people from the lab that are willing to donate time and actually write up code to answer those specific problems. I think the one problem that I have seen is that there still hasn't been a real good mesh of that, but it's getting there, And I think that over time you will see more integration, I think, of the two.
Well, yeah, it's interesting then. I'm wondering how the what the quality of the BioPerl code is then, if it's written somewhat by biologist Bart Perl.
Sorry. Well, it depends on who you ask, but tried to audit. I mean, I got involved. It's been many years now, like almost 10 years. And, I was trained as a computer scientist, but I moved from computer science into a more biological field. So we certainly tried to take it to heart, the right kinds of coding principles, but it's often harder because you have a lot of different skill levels of people contributing. So we have tried to have sort of this cabal of core programmers that kind of manage to do some code audits, and we've gone back over time and tried to really improve and standardize things. But yeah, it's a challenge. I would say that the quality is pretty good. I think it's interesting when there are companies who want some sort of compliant certification of our code, and we really have no idea what that means in this case. So we haven't been able to fulfill that need. But I think the example is really how much it's used. And when we have hundreds of examples of publications where people have used the code to solve problems, either in a small way or other examples of really large projects where people have tried to take it, at least the basic toolkit level, and build programs on top of it. So even though we say that you might need like a tinkerer in your lab to be able to solve the problems your lab has, there's still a lot of use in kind of a higher end in companies and in some of these big academic projects that it does see that kind of use and does get a lot of stress testing through that. So yes, I think bioinformatics grows very fast. And so you get a lot of different kinds of people that get sucked into this interesting field. And so they come here with a lot of different backgrounds. In terms of training, we have both backgrounds coming into graduate programs, people who have a biology focus that want to learn computational aspects. And then you have a lot of computer scientists who are looking for more interesting problems in the computational field. So I think you get both.
And we do have, I have to say, we do have a pretty decent, it's not perfect by any means, but we have a pretty large test suite for the programs and the modules that we have. So we do add tests to the BioPerl core and to the various modules and extensions of BioPerl. In many cases, we learn, just like any other software project, from the bug reports that come in on what areas are lacking. We have, and I think something that might pop up in a little while is the speed of BioPerl.
You did have the advantage that you started this after Perl 5 arrived, so you probably is a fair amount of Perl object orientation with it, and maybe some good tests and testing using test more and things like that. So you probably don't have some of the problems that the early web developers had, where a lot of it was done under Perl 4, and so there was this Perl 4 legacy feel to a lot of the code. So is that true? Has this all been written in the Perl 5 era?
No, I think some of it has been. I don't know, Jason, do you know this?
There's like two modules. So the initial first two modules was like a sequence module and then I think like an alignment module. And they were sort of Perl 4-ish, but all of that code was completely replaced at some point down the line. So yeah, I think it's all Perl 5 written, and we have an object oriented kind of component that fits with Perl 5, and we do have a very extensive test suite, and we actually tried to do this whole implementation where we used some of the other language toolkits that are doing some of these similar things, so we could round trip data. So we did have a lot of tests to make sure that we were round tripping data from one format all the way to the other and back, and really showing that we didn't lose anything and we're at least kind of compliant at that level.
Cool. What else is in this space? Is there BioPython? Is there BioRuby?
Yeah. Yes. Exactly.
BioJava.
Yeah, BioJava was sort of the second sister project, and then BioPython, BioRuby. So, and there is a BioLib project that's trying to do some C crossover to make it easier to have the C programs accessible from all these different toolkits. There was a BioCorba project a long time ago, which died a happy death, and we have some other infrastructure projects that are supported that do more at the web services level. So. There was a BioXML at one point, although that's sort of been replaced. And trying to think if there's any other ones that we have. BioSQL, there's a BioSQL project for representing some of the data. So I don't know. It's kind of a joke now that we have all these bio projects. But
now, is there enough code in BioPerl to cover pretty much what everybody wants to do, or do you really need to pick also your language as well as your tasks then?
There's definitely a lot of the major things. We don't do protein structures very well in BioPerl. We have a little bit of stuff for parsing that, but there's some great visualization code in Python that's been developed that so a lot of people do that. And actually, in fact, I mentioned that someone who just passed away recently, Warren Delano, was one of the big developers of the PyMOL project, which is in Python, and that's one of the reasons why Python is a really strong language for protein structure data. But I think we cover a lot of the major stuff in Perl. Again, this is an open source volunteer project, so the kind of things that get done are really what scratches the developers' itches. And so there's a lot of focus on depending on who's involved in the projects. And there tends to be a little bit more machine learning people involved in the Java project, BioJava. So there's a lot more support for that kind of stuff, whereas I think we're a bit more really just focus on sequence data, text parsing that has to go with that in Perl.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to say that, we're looking at the world nowadays, as biologists walking out into a field, looking at the living world no longer necessarily as morphology, as, physiology, but we're looking at it as ACs, Ts, and Gs, not only in the static state of those genomes, but by the fact that those genomes are active, genes are being expressed at all times to match the conditions. Right, so there's an enormous amount of data if you look at the world that way. Do you spend your time looking at the world that way, or are you spending more of your effort, your personal efforts right now, developing BioPerl? And if you're using it, what are your favorite examples? What was the best science that you've seen coming off of BioPerl? A loaded question.
Sure.
Do you see the matrix first?
Do I see the matrix?
A, C, T, and G. Yeah.
To some extent. I mean, a lot of the challenges in doing biological research I do step back and say, well, this is, BioPerl is a tool to answer the questions. And so it's not, for me, it's not an end. I mean, it's a means to an end, but it's not really the main focus of my research. So we use it as a way to, yes, to look at gene expression and also to look at variation in population. So population level genetics as well. And what I've used BioPerl for in several of the genome projects that we do. So we do think about the genome in terms of static, but we're comparing it to lots of other genomes to think about it in terms of evolutionary context. And so BioPerl is really integral in being able to make sense of this comparative data. So we're aligning a genome. So I work on fungi, and there's more than 100 fungal genomes out there. And so we're making comparisons between things that diverged, almost a billion years ago, and we're finding regions in the genome that are in common, and we're able to then make some inference about maybe the properties of the morphology, perhaps, or just the phenotypes of some of the earliest fungi. And so we're doing this because we're able to process the output of these comparative tools, and often it means processing it and then reprocessing it into a different format, running one program, reprocessing that into another format, and so there's just, we can do this a lot faster because we're doing it all basically in scripts and in pipelines, and we can change one bit of the input and rerun the whole thing. And so that's really the strength that I've seen in the kind of analyses that we do.
Is that a billion years ago, give or take 500 million? You wrote this in a paper, and I thought it was brilliant. It came out of Current Biology this year. Oh, it says about a billion years ago, give or take 500 million years.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, the fungi just don't have the same kind of bone structure as animals, so we don't get these fossils to help us date that. But at least in terms of other context, a billion is a reasonable starting point.
Can you use the genome to evaluate the age?
Oh, we can, but you have to calibrate it. So you can count how many changes there are between organisms and use that as a way to kind of, the number of changes is correlated with time, but the rates change in different lineages. And so you have to have some way to know how that clock, how fast that clock is ticking. And so there are some attempts at that, and that's kind of how we get that 500 million years, I mean, that a billion years. But there's a lot of uncertainty in that estimation is the problem.
I was involved in a project here that looked at archaea, which are the bacteria that grow, or they'll say bacteria, actually, archaea are microorganisms that grow in hydrothermal vents and are in extreme environments. And we used the Yellowstone geological events, to time specific divergences, to estimate when those were. But it's a tricky business, I think. But at the same time, that's what you have to work with.
Wow, it's a lot of stuff. I'm sorry, my eyes are glazing over at all the biology stuff. So I'm waiting for another question about the computer stuff.
Talk grep and C-PAN till your face is blue, but as soon as you talk biology, Randall goes, what? Oh, bicycles. Let's talk about bicycles. You know, something
exactly.
Anything else.
Getting back to the parts that I can relate to. So this is an open source project. Lots of people are contributing. And I presume it's actually somewhat specialized in that you probably have parts of the community that are sort of isolated from each other, because this really isn't an overall project then, right? BioPearl is really a lot of little pieces, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we do have sort of small groups of people that kind of come and go. And in fact, there's a language separation too, to some extent. We go to common meetings, but, you know, the Python group will have their little birds of a feather meeting, and the Perl people have theirs, and, you know, we throw things at them. But no, it's good because it's small enough that you can know most of the people that are working on things. And so you can try to communicate. But one of the things we've noticed over time is that in terms of the psychology of how you run a project like this is that, you know, you can do it for a while, but it starts to, all you end up getting at the end is bug reports on stuff that you wrote like 4 years ago. And sometimes people aren't asking you about the most recent stuff, and that gets a little bit difficult. So I think people kind of come and go in this project, which is great. We'd love for people to drop in and make great contributions and go on, you know, or come up with some better way to optimize things and go on their way. But we've tried hard to keep a core of people that are technically understand the biology and are good Perl programmers that can oversee it. And so it's an effort to keep it going. But
now, does anybody come to BioPearl and say, oh yuck, it's Perl, I hate Perl?
Yes.
Yeah. Of course.
It happens a lot. And I get computer scientists asking, why are you teaching Perl to your biology students as their first language? And there's a lot of things that come with that. To be honest, my it's important to me is that people are out there actually asking the important questions they want to ask in their research, and I don't really care what language they use, but I'm going to be the best able to help them if it's a language that I know pretty well. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we do get a lot of sort of thumb in their nose at Perl from and there's actually a BioRuby project that where there's a lot of new efforts that people have been putting to that, but they're actually really friendly in terms of learning from what we've done and building on it. So I think. People see the strengths in each language.
And I have had some interaction recently with the BioPython crowd. And they're very friendly and supportive, probably a little different than some Python programmers are towards Perl programmers. But they tend to be very supportive and help out quite a bit with problems. And it is a kind of advice. It's kind of a interaction that works both ways. I mean, we help them, they help us. It does seem to work out in a mutually beneficial way.
Well, I think it's different because you're really talking about biologists first for the most part, and having learned these languages as a secondary thing to what they have done. So you have more in common because you're talking about all that gobbledygook in 10 minutes ago that you guys were saying, right? You're talking all about that. You're saying, and I load this module in Perl to, you know, talk to this machine and talk to that program and make those hook together. And that's sort of secondary to what you're really trying to get done. So it's not like us, where, you know, those of us that came from a computer science background where it's like, okay, oh my God, I've got to be in the Perl camp. And boy, the Python people are scary to me.
The interesting aspect that I'm seeing now is we are starting to see a number of people joining the project who are programmers who are trying to solve a biological question. And so they're not biologists going and trying to solve a computational questions. So we are getting people who Perl programmers who are using more modern tools, for instance, Moose and DBIX class, right? I believe. Mm-hmm. And they're using those specific tools to answer more questions. And I'm actually starting to use Moose a bit myself and find it actually quite useful. I like it quite a bit.
Yeah, Moose is pretty good. It's coming along quite well. We're going to get the Moose guys on here at some point. So a lot of this is probably talking to databases. Then, are you guys using MySQL, Postgres, Oracle on the back end for your data storage?
I've used MySQL. I believe there's a BioSQL project that has adapters for that BioPerl interacts with, BioPerl DB, and it has MySQL, PG, I think Oracle, and I think somebody was trying to write up an SQLite version, but I'm not quite sure how far that's gone.
Okay, go ahead.
I was going to say also Lincoln Stein, who's been mentioned quite frequently here, has a database set up that he uses called Seek Feature Store that's within BioPerl. And that uses several different adapters, MySQL, I think, and I'm trying to remember. I think SQLite and PG as well. So,
yeah, and an in-memory implementation too. So, yeah, it's all we pretty much serve as many open source databases as people have needs for. I mean, there's some more features in the Postgres database that are used for some of these. That are used for some projects, but I think a majority of people that we talk to probably are doing MySQL first and then kind of adding Postgres if they need the extra triggers and transaction support.
Now, are all these modules ending up in the CPAN then? Is that your method of coordination and cooperation, or do you have your own independent repositories for this stuff?
We have our own independent repository, but everything gets pushed out to CPAN once we make a release. We just Chris and I have been pumpkins in the past, and it's a real fun time suck. But yeah, so we took us a long time to get between 1.6 and the last 1.5 or whatever that we did. So but we really try hard to not release code that hasn't been gone through a pretty rigorous set of tests, and so that's one of the reasons it's taken us a while between releases in the past. But I think Chris has got us on a better schedule now.
Yeah, we're doing point releases fairly regularly now, though I was a little behind the last one. But I think we're going to try to push out another point release by Christmas. That's the schedule right now. We also have several different, we talked about BioDB, which is the interface to BioSQL that's BioPerl specific. And that I'm supposed to be pushing out the final release of that here fairly soon. So It's a bit labor intensive, but it's, I think, a bit more streamlined than it used to be, and a lot easier to deal with regarding tests. I think one of the problems we ran into in the past was that tests were run, particularly network tests related tests were run that tank any kind of CPAN installation, and we've streamlined that somewhat so that unless the specific module's installed, of course, then those won't be run, or unless they're specifically asked to run this specific test, they won't be run. So, and make it easier.
And now, before I let Mark or Dr. Kiki make this more biology oriented again, I got to ask you one other obvious question: Emacs or VI? Emacs or VI? Both of you.
Emacs for me.
Jason. Emacs. Yeah.
Emacs. All right.
Yeah.
Okay, Mark, you wanted to ask.
So when are we going to have BioLisp? That's what I want to know.
Oh, there is a BioLisp, actually.
Is there a BioLisp?
Yeah. I mean, it's not affiliated with our foundation projects, but it's definitely, they've done some stuff with it.
So, wow. Yeah. That's interesting.
There's even a BioHaskell, I think, out there.
Oh, somewhere. Erlang, baby.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're waiting. Go ahead. You can, okay. Mark. Next. You have a Mac. That's what you said, or is that what you said, Mark? Yeah.
I have a Mac. Yes, but not an Mac. So you guys are talking library or databases that are libraries that contain the code. So this is where my ignorance is, and just like the reverse on the anti Randall right here, with respect to our understandings don't converge. There's no overlap yet. The database. How can you guys interface with the National Center for Biological Information? That's where I go for everything in terms of information. Do you have code that can go in and do blast searches through that? Assemble through that? Do you make use of NCBI?
Right. Yeah. We actually do have code that you could submit sequences for blast analyses through NCBI directly. You don't have to have BLAST locally installed. I wrote up code that will interact with NCBI's e-utilities, which is the interface to all of our databases, but it does it in a sort of generic way. So it actually doesn't involve a lot of BioPerl code. It's more a toolkit within a toolkit and BioPerl. We also have several packages, so you can say, I want this sequence from NCBI, and it'll give you the actual sequence object back from NCBI. So,
and it, we can also deal with publication data too. So we can also download data from the PubMed database, and also the sorry, I'm just seeing my Twitter feed of people saying stuff about this.
Don't read your Twitter feed.
And we also have the ability to talk to other data, any database that had a pretty standardized web interface to being able to ask for a particular, you give an accession number and you get back a sequence. We have a few wrappers for that to make it easier. So the one thing we didn't talk about so much, but is that we really try to genericize how the toolkit gets its data. So we have flat files where a lot of data has sort of traditionally been stored. There's, of course, databases where we have some local implementations where you could query the database and get sequences back. And then there's, of course, web-based databases where you would run some sort of HTTP request and get back a sequence stream. And so those are all basically we've written the code so it can be generic to whatever kind of resource that is. And we can, the parsers can deal with the data format, and that's separate from the request or the fetching. And so to really try to make it a flexible system so that you can have your own local instance of a particular database, as long as you set up some standard, either you adhere to a known standard or you write your own interface to it, then the data could be retrieved.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody has anything to say. They're all so
nothing
quiet.
At all.
Well, I have a billion questions, but I certainly don't want this.
You can monopolize it, Mark. That's fine. You're in this business, right?
Well, I don't do so much a lot of genetic analysis. I do pharmacological development and making.
I'm curious. Actually, of both you and Dr. Kiki, how much scientists do their own programming? I mean, don't you have like a grad student to do that for you?
I was that grad student once. Oh, okay.
Yeah, I think we all were grad students at that.
Yeah.
That's something that is that's an interesting point, which is, you know, how do you get this kind of this new technological advancement, this programming development, to the people who are going to use it? How do you get older scientists who maybe haven't been programming in Perl, don't know much about it, or even scientists who do know some programming but just don't see this project as being much of a use. And then how do you also get it out to the new students? I mean, having classes, obviously, in the biological sciences for programming in Perl, yeah, that's helpful. But how do you, I mean, beyond that, what do you do? How do you get it to people?
It's a challenge. It's definitely a challenge that we, and I guess it takes a certain kind of person who wants to learn it if at the beginning. So, I mean, when I started graduate school, I already knew some programming and I knew I wanted to use the computers to answer my research questions. But for the older, for scientists who haven't grown up through that, there are courses and we do try to teach tutorials through. So there's a tutorial at Cold Spring Harbor that's essentially programming Perl for biologists that teaches a lot of different skills, mainly focused on Perl, but some database stuff too. And then we have a lot of how-tos on our website that we've started from. It's there's a sort of this, because most of us are academics, there's this issue with whether or not you spending your time writing tutorials is going to help your academic career. You kind of have to find a way to balance that between doing the writing the publications that are going to be part of your research package. But but I think
publish or perish.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I mean, there's a lot of scientists out there blogging and making, showing that they can demonstrate how important information transfer is to the public through that work. And so I think over time we will show that pushing this kind of literacy of programming to more scientists. I mean, lots and lots of people want to know how to do this.
Yeah.
And if we can make it streamlined for them to kind of get it, that would be helpful. I mean, I think, it's important that it's part of also the open source component, is that, you're doing things in science so that people can build on them. And so you have to make your code available in such a way that people can use it. And so I think that teaching people how to read that and how to build upon those algorithms is just as important in the scientific learning process.
Yeah, if I had known about things like BioPerl when I was in grad school, trying to come up with ways to access data, to manage data, to play scientifically, it could have been so helpful. But no,
it's just scientists now have to learn. I mean, has science become so computational that you have to learn computer science, or at least a little bit?
I would actually recommend it.
Yeah, I would recommend it.
Absolutely.
Interesting. Well, yeah.
But, you know, the alternative is to buy software that does the analysis for you.
Mm-hmm. And they're extremely expensive.
$5,000 to $10,000 a pop.
Wow.
Yeah, and who can afford that? Unless
it's not really.
So GCG is a very popular set of programs, and GCG, I don't know what the subscription price of it is these days, but I think at one point it was what $5,000 a year per year.
Yeah. And you still do some programming, right? I mean, if it's any good, you're going to have to do some programming in it, right?
Right.
Yeah. And you should understand how it works, too. You should understand the basis of the program so that you know how to input data in an effective manner.
Right.
So they trust the algorithm that's been coded for them, and they'd rather write the algorithm themselves.
Right.
Yeah.
That does happen, too. But I think also with GCG is a good example where the MBOS toolkit, which is the European Molecular Biology Open Source Software Toolkit, I'm getting some letters wrong there, but they're an open source project that basically re-implemented everything that's in GCG, and it's all completely free and open, and they have a great community of people that and actually I learned how to do several alignment algorithms by reading their C code, because it's all available, and it made more sense to me in some ways than some of the textbook examples that we're starting with. So I think having that as a resource, having tools like that as a resource, is really important for the learning process too.
You know, that really brings up a point then, that open source in this area is really, you know, I don't think of open source so much for like scientific applications like this, but to be able to build on other people's open source work and to understand not just through, you know, the learning of the basic algorithms from the textbooks, but actually learning from the actual source codes available, that's got to be something that really helps empower the learning and research in this area, correct?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I think it's critical for stuff. And I think that's why, you know, all of us are big proponents in the project. I'm big proponents of this source code being available, both from a principle standpoint, but also from an advancement of science standpoint. And I think that I think there's plenty of examples where this has happened. Where so, for example, the Hammer, which is another package that's an important sequence analysis tool, is a completely open source toolkit. And there's this great example now where there's companies collaborating with Sean Eddy's lab to be able to add additional improvements to the algorithms, and it's all being done in this open source manner so that the whole community benefits. Even though this if this had been a commercial package, and I think they're sort of related ones, they could sell it for thousands of dollars. This is all a completely free and available tool that's essential for a lot of the kinds of sequence analysis that people do today. So, I think it's really important for being able to build upon the existing knowledge.
And I've also got to imagine that if you're at the bleeding edge of the science on this, that as your research progresses, you realize, and you'll have to explain this to me if I'm not saying the right things, but like as you're figuring out ways to like line these things up, you may discover that certain combinations really aren't possible. And you've got to teach your software to not do that anymore right away. You can't wait for some development cycle and bug report cycle with some commercial software. You've got to fix it today to get your proper research on tomorrow, correct?
Right. Correct.
Absolutely. No, it happens all the time.
You guys are coming in at every time. Right? We're entering a genomics era. So the up till 10 years ago, or even 8 years ago, people were sequencing genes, you know, 700 bases at a time, and things were fairly simple. But now with the new technologies that are available, and any core facility in a department, an academic department can afford one of these pretty much now, can generate mountains and mountains and mountains of data, and then see that world through the eyes of the world of ACTNG, right? So
there's one facility I know of that in California somewhere, I believe, that can sequence the human genome, I think, 24 times over with the sequencers they have available in a week. So it's the technology is there. And next summer, a number of these newer next generation sequences are going to be coming out. So you'll be able to do this within probably day, maybe?
I'm trying to get Leo's genome. George Church is doing the Personal Genome Project, and we've been subscribing. You know, you can subscribe to get your genome taken care of or analyzed. And it's getting to a point, yes, you could probably do a human genome in a week or so, depending on how much resources you put towards it. And it'd be really fun if we could get Leo to jump on board with George Church. That way, he could publicize this information and make sort of...
Actually, what I'd like to do is clone myself, because I'm getting kind of tired, and maybe if... I can make a few more.
Your clone would be a baby, so you still have to raise it. So I don't know. That's
hard. That's right.
Oh, shoot. We accelerate the growth.
But it could be weird in the womb of the TriCaster.
Yeah, maybe I could just put the... Can we just make the brain and not, you know, deal with the rest of the stuff?
Leo, we just need to feed your gene into the MakerBot from a couple weeks
ago.
That's
right. We got a little printer. We'll build a
DNA and just have a giant-sized Leo.
No, I'll be glad to do that, Mark. I think that sounds very cool. I'd love to... What I need to do? Give you a hair?
No, it would be a little swab from the cheek.
For the cheek swab.
Send it over to Kurt. So
email me the information and I'll do it. I've wanted to do that for a while. Is that the same one the National Geographic's doing?
No, this is the Personal Genome Project. So George Church was involved early on at the start in the 80s. He was a high school student sequencing DNA by crystallography.
Jeez,
so he,
Louise.
Yeah, the heart, you know, unbelievable. No, the next step was, of course, doing multiplexing sequencing. So get multiple runs at the same time. He did that in the 80s. And he connected with Lee Hood, who invented the DNA sequencer. And there was a group of six, including those two.
There he is.
You can't miss him.
And so he's a fan of Floss.
Great.
He actually listens to Floss.
Great.
And maybe one or two episodes of Fib. He's been on a couple of times. But so the point being is that there's an enormous amount of genomes being sequenced. But we should not worry about the information about it. We can just look at you and tell an enormous amount of information about you and your health. So the genome might actually help you prevent... or tell you a little bit about some of the things that you may not know that you have. But one of the deals with their personal genome...
I'm not sure I want to find out, to be honest with you.
But there is that aspect of it.
You do, Leo. We all want to make sure that you're healthy. And
you have a limp. No, they wouldn't say that.
It won't tell you whether or not you have a limp.
Okay.
No, that's a little different.
There's a lot of genetics coming out. And
I'd love to do that. I think that's fascinating. And can I then do a show with George and you about that?
I think that would be a lot of fun.
I think it should focus on the limits of personal genomics.
Okay, that's good too. Yes. Yeah, sure.
That would be a good show. That would be a good one.
Yeah.
But this one, you guys are right at the pivotal time when there's an enormous amount of information. And having all these tools become available for free just means a lot of graduate students can have a lot of fun without worrying about downloading, right?
Well, the other thing that we're looking at is cloud-based computing. And actually, there's some work now. We're trying to get some work started here on implementing some cloud-based tools within BioPearl, but that's still kind of in the beginnings of things. There are several tools that are available through Amazon. I believe there's CloudBurst, I believe, and Crossbow, which are used for next-generation sequencing because you're dealing with such huge amounts of data that you have to have something that will run on a remote system. And we have a couple of people here that are very interested in the problem that are developing their own tools. So we're very interested in getting cloud-based work, cloud-based computing resources going.
Wow.
But I think it's an interesting time, I think, as Mark was bringing up and to sort of interface those two, is that there's a lot of data being generated. A lot of it's being dumped in the public domain. And I think on top of that, many sequencing, many universities and have sequencing cores that can generate essentially as much data that was generated last year that was put into the databases can be generated from one sequencing center, I think essentially with one of these machines. So we're talking like, so there's 16, I think the number is like 16 gigabases of sequencer deposited last year, and we can easily surpass that with one machine over the course of a year. So it completely changes the game. Everybody can sequence whatever they want, you know, in the next couple of years. And so
the problem is shifted to data analysis now. So it's shifted to the point of, okay, you can do all of this work in the lab, but now you got to analyze all of these sequences somehow, and how are you going to do it?
Right.
So that becomes an issue of resources and how you're going to, and that's one reason Amazon and having these cloud-based systems available for researchers is a pretty important thing.
How much data is it and how computationally intensive is it?
We have a local Hadoop cluster that can take, I think it's Selexaron, I think, is around 20 million sequences, and it can do it in about an hour.
Wow. That's amazing.
So, yeah. I mean, it's a local one, but I think that there's a comparable one on Amazon that can run at about the same length of time. So the issue then is cost. $100 I think is what the cost was on Amazon last time I checked for that length of time for that particular size cluster. And we have some tools here that may bring that cost down. Although we're still speccing that out, but they're talking about $5 a run.
Wow.
So,
and this is something that you've talked about, Mark, I know on the show, which is kind of, it's the first step to personalized medicine. Mm-hmm. It's just fascinating.
And having fun doing it.
Yeah.
Because
And what would this have been? What cost would this have been, say, 10 years ago? I mean, we've really come a long ways with this. Is this something that would have taken massive supercomputers, you know, weeks with supercomputer payment time? Or, I mean, what's the order of magnitude that we've actually been able to cut in the last 10 years with this kind of stuff?
I don't know. What do you think, Jason?
I mean, it's
a human genome. Cost
right, so three billion bases. I mean, I actually was just trying to bring up, I had some numbers on that in terms of what the cost is, the cost for sequencing it was, but I think it was about basically like, I think $3.5 billion to sequence the human genome. I think I'm getting that right.
Yeah,
I should check.
I think just a week ago they came out with, it was sequenced for $5,000 was the most recent number.
Yeah, right.
I paid
but in terms of compute on it, I think was Randall's question. I don't know because, of course, that was distributed across a lot of different institutes that had different questions. And it really depends on what you're trying to do. So if you're just looking for like, so personal genomics and resequencing, you're basically taking, we already know pretty much what the genome looks like. We're taking your DNA and trying to see what differences do you have to sort of the reference and whether or not you have variation that's found in common with other people. And so that is a pretty straightforward problem for certain things. And so that can be done with not so much, with a single desktop can run for a few hours, I think, and kind of in process that. I don't, these algorithms for mapping these short reads is every month there's like another one with another improvement. And so it's hard to keep up with what's the
it's
most
a very,
common
very new area. Yeah, it's kind of a pretty new spot. In fact, a lot of the software that I just talked about that was cloud-based, that's I think within the last literally 2-3 months those have come out. So it's a pretty exciting area to be in, but yeah, it's still very new.
Well, it sounds like a very exciting area to be in. It makes me want to stop everything I'm doing and go play with this again. Like every time I have one of these shows, it's always like, oh, I want to go play with this now. Definitely cool. And I really appreciate you guys coming on today and talking about what you're doing with BioPearl and just giving us a glimpse into the field and the stuff. It's just thank you guys both for being on the show.
No problem.
Of course. Enjoyed it very much. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. Yeah. Jason Stach and Chris Fields. Take care. BioPearl.org. is the place to go for more information. Thank you, guys.
Mm-hmm. Sure thing. Thanks, Leo.
And Mark, I was just reading about the Personal Genome Project. I think that's very interesting.
Well, you're at
I would volunteer
this
for that.
Large community. So if you did it, then you'd have, you know.
Well, I'm reading about it on Wikipedia, and I mean, it is a huge invasion of privacy.
Huge.
Because not only are they publishing your genotype with your name. Mm-hmm. But also phenotype information, medical records, measurements, MRI images, and so forth.
The amount of information in terms of modern medicine. I mean,
is it beneficial or is it political? I mean, is there benefit to having this data?
Sure. Look, you could look at people with predisposition to certain types of diseases where we haven't figured out.
So it helps you find gene sites. I see. Okay.
No, among other things, but, you know, if we're looking at longevity or we're looking at heart disease, we're looking at cancer, we're looking at...
Tell Dr. Church I would be very glad to volunteer, and maybe that would make a statement that others might want to follow. I don't know, but I'd be glad to do it because I have nothing to lose at this point, you know.
Look,
I can't lose my insurance. I'm already very public.
No, there's safeguards for that in Congress. Here's an important thing. Do you want to make your medical decision based on your family history or your molecular anatomy?
Give me anatomy or give me death.
Well, they're both going to be related.
This would include both. This includes all your phenotype information as well as your genome.
As well as your genome. It seems.
Is there a cost
great
to this?
For personal stuff? I'm just concerned.
So it's part of his goal, his project.
Yeah.
What would your concerns be, Peaky? Well, tell me why I shouldn't do this.
Well, you personally, I think it would be fine.
I don't think everybody should do it necessarily.
Yeah, I think for a number of people, though, opening up, I mean, having your name and personal information associated with this and publicly available, I don't think that's necessarily what a lot of people would want to do. And I don't know that that's necessarily helpful. I mean, you can take people's names, personal information out of it and still have it be extremely useful for research and for data collection.
The point Church is making is that this stuff is going to, it's almost impossible to secure it. So if you're going to participate at least in the initial measurements.
Go all the way.
Go all the way. And, you know, Esther Dyson has done this. Of course, Dr. Mm-hmm. Church has done it himself. There's an article.
What about the problem, though, that I think just recently they said they were able to fake DNA evidence for crime scenes given people's genetic readout?
I don't think there's any risk of me being accused of murder or rape in the near future. If you're going to pick somebody to
I Leo put, was at the scene.
I was there. No, I can prove I was on the air. I've got tapes.
You could pepper some DNA in a salt pepper shaker and just put it around a crime scene if you really want
to. I guess you're right. You don't need to have a genome to do
that. Yeah, and you just drop some Tris, right? Tris base, and then it looks like there was some, you know, sort of contamination by, or, you know, plant.
This is fascinating. So, but please, if you're in contact with Dr. Church, Mark, I would be glad to be a guinea pig in this and do a show about it and talk a little bit about it. I think it sounds fascinating.
Well, Dr. Kiki asked some really relevant ethical issues here, and maybe, you know, you could ask Dr. Church, why would you want your genome to be public? It's a really important question. If there's pros and cons, that'd be really fascinating.
Well, we got a show. It sounds like we got a show. So if you just ask Dr. Church, and we could do it as part of your show or as part of Dr. Kiki's show, or we could do a special, which I would like to do too. That'd be a lot of fun, and put it on both feeds.
But I'd like to thank Randall for inviting me to be a guest on or co-host. Really awesome to meet these guys.
And thank you, Mark, for coming on the show and asking a lot of questions that I wouldn't have gotten to otherwise. You too, Dr. Kiki. Those are both great questions, or both great lines of questions that you guys were able to ask for this. Because I'm just a programmer. I don't know the rest of this stuff.
Just
a programmer who can't seem to keep his Skype up. So let me just call him right back here.
He's like, and I'm done.
That was it. I'm out of here. I am out of here.
I'm just a programmer, and I pushed the hang up button on Skype.
No, did you really?
Yes. Yeah, well, you know,
I don't know how to use these computer things.
You know what's funny is the hang-up button is just a red circle, though, on Skype.
Yeah.
And it's active all the way to the edge,
yep,
even though the button's not there. So that freaks me out. I'm trying to move my Skype window a little bit, and I grab it on the gray area, and it's actually still the red button, but it doesn't look like it is. So I'm an idiot. It works that way.
You know, it says that in your genome. In fact, I'm looking right here.
That's great.
Right there, look, he's in it. No.
I was always saying, thank you guys both for being on, and I really appreciate it. And can we talk about upcoming guests, sir Leo?
Please, let's.
Okay. Oh, and I'm getting static on this call.
Well, let's just ignore that because we don't hear it right now. So you just go right ahead.
Right.
Who is coming up on the show?
Yeah, coming up. Let me pull up my little sheet here. Coming up next week, we have Wolfgang Meyer talking about the EXIST database with a capital X for some reason. That's an XML-based database because part of the problems with XML is it's hierarchical data and doesn't fit so well in rows and columns of SQL. So he's got an entire open-source database that deals quickly with XML hierarchical data. That'll be really cool. Coming up right after him, we have our friend Joe Brockmeyer, also known as Zonker. I was going to talk about OpenSUSE, the new 11.2 release that was about 6 months late.
Oh, I can't wait.
He's got to talk about all that.
Yep.
That's going to be a great show. And then, of course, your friend and mine, the whole reason that Floss Weekly exists is our friend Chris DeBona is coming on to talk about things that have happened in the last 3 years in the open source world. Got a bunch of other guests coming up following that. But if you go to the spreadsheet at twit.tv/floss, a link from there anyway, you'll be able to see who we've got coming up soon, shortly. And
Chris has
you can
a fairly
find
good
information there for about for getting...
Chris, Chris has a fairly good ringside seat to that, being the open source, the manager of open source programs for Google.
Indeed, yes. He's the Google coordinator that I actually bumped into him a few weeks ago at the AstroCon Astros show, and it was a great conversation that he did there, and I'm hoping he'll bring some of that information to us. Again, go to twit.tv/floss. Also, if you're in the Portland area, I am doing my Ignite Portland talk, which is the talk about karaoke for fun and profit, my 5-minute talk for Ignite, my first Ignite. I'm really excited. Come along, go to igniteportland.com. It's Thursday night, the 19th in Portland, Oregon. So if you're around, please come. And I know they're taping that, so eventually videos of me will be up on YouTube as well.
Great. Well, thank you all so much. Thanks to our guests, and thanks, of course, to Dr. Kiki for helping, sitting in, and Mark Pelletier.
Learning.
Yep. Dr. Kiki's show is This Week in Science at twist.org. She also hosts Dr. Kiki's Science Hour, which we do every Thursday afternoon, and is a podcast by now.
Yes.
If Leo does his job tonight.
Leo is going to do his job. I'm going to use the Jedi mind trick on you, Leo.
This is the podcast feed you're supposed to make. Mark Pelletier does Futures in Biotech, also on the Twit Network at twit.tv/fib, or go to futuresinbiotech.com to read the blog. And is a biotech researcher who's going to help me get my exome mapped.
Cool.
Can't wait.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So excited. Thank you for joining us, Mark. Thank you, Randall Schwartz. Randall is at stonehenge.com. You can email him, randall@twit.tv. And we will be back next week with another exciting, thrilling, gripping edition of Floss Weekly. We'll see you then.